So the topic of today's lecture is going to be basically, what's the correct way, in my point of view, on how to define causal relations, and more generally, how to disentangle causation from inference. So I'm going to start with some sort of old philosophical ideas on causation, most of which come out of an empiricist tradition in the philosophy of science. So if you read David Hume, this is kind of one of the starting points on all discussions of causations, is this notion of constant conjunction. So I won't read the quote, but in Hume's point of view, if you empirically see that certain things are constantly occurring together, then that's all that causation really is. So no other notion of cause and effect, but that there's this constant conjunction. So that is essentially saying something like a correlation between two events should be count as causation. And you could try to formalize that as just, if I see some correlation between A and B, then I should say that A causes B. But of course, that won't work. Remember that this P B given A not equal to P of B, meaning that, conditioning on A allows me to update what I know about B, is equivalent to these other forms. And it means it's symmetric between A and B. So give a concrete example. An example of correlation is the sun rising, the rooster crowing, but it's a symmetric relation, meaning if I'm in the farmhouse with the curtains drawn and I can't tell whether the sun has risen or not, if I hear the rooster crow, I can infer that the sun has risen. And then conversely, if I read in my farmer's almanac that, 2 weeks from now, the sun will rise at exactly 7 a.m., then I can infer that, the rooster will crow at that time. So basically, for the purposes of making inferences, I can go in either direction. And so, I get this inequality for both cases, whether I'm conditioning on the sunrise or the rooster crowing. But we know that the causal relation is asymmetric. So you can imagine a different possible world where the rooster didn't crow. You expect the sun will still rise. Whereas in a possible world where the sun didn't rise at the expected time, maybe because you moved the rooster towards, on the earth, then the rooster doesn't crow at the expected time. So that's really the difference. You expect causation to be an asymmetric relation. And so no attempt to define it in terms of purely correlation is going to work. One idea would be to just try a simple fix where you somehow stipulate that, it's correlation, but you've got to demand that A is somehow prior to B in time or something like that. And then, you can say, well, it's the fact that the brightening of the sky happens before the rooster crowing is what solves that problem. But we already saw last time that's not going to work either, because correlation can still be achieved even though A is earlier than B. And when A doesn't cause B, just by virtue of some common cause. So this was the Simpson's paradox example. And in it, you could imagine that, men are both more likely to seek treatment and more likely to recover. And that's what sets up a correlation between these two variables, even though there's actually no causal relation at all. So we need something, this fix doesn't work either. We talked last time about how, in the context of Simpson's paradox, where you have both the causal arrow and the common cause, you want to stratify the data by the common cause, sort of look at each gender to find out what the causal impact of treatment on recovery is. And I mentioned that there's something called a do conditional. So I want to define now what a do conditional is. So the standard conditional, so P of R given T, recovery variable given treatment variable, is expressed this way. It's that, what do I learn about recovery when I learn the treatment variable? So I learn about recovery, what do I infer about recovery given treatment and gender? And what do I infer about gender given treatment? By sum over the genders, this is the overall probability of recovery given treatment as an inference. And the key is that I can learn something about the gender by learning the treatment in these examples we saw last time, where men and women were at different probability of taking the treatment. That's the standard conditional. And the idea of a do conditional is to imagine a different possible world where the treatment, all the arrows into treatment are suspended. So in this different possible world, gender does not impact treatment. So you're sort of imagining a world where it really is like a randomized controlled trial, where you can set the treatment variable independently of things like gender and other possible confounders that might hold in the real world. And then the idea is that you again look at the probability of recovery given treatment, but now you're averaging the probability of recovery given treatment and gender just by the probability of the different genders, not the probability of gender conditioned on treatment. Okay, so you're taking an average over the genders. That's the only place the treatment variable shows up is in this conditional, which means it's only reflecting this arrow here. So in other words, this do conditional is basically the regular conditional in this other world you're imagining where treatment would be freely specifiable. Okay, so the moral of the story about Simpson's paradox is that if I want to compute the do conditional, I average these expressions with the probability of male and female, and I trust that when I make my decisions about whether to use the drug or not. And that's different from just the standard conditional. So you might think, all right, then the candidate definition for A causes B is that this do conditional be non-trivial, meaning that if I look at the probability of B when I've made A take some value or considered some possible world where A takes a particular value independently of anything else, then that should be different from the distribution over B where I don't set A. And in my experience, a lot of causal inference literature doesn't come out and say that this is how we're defining causation, but it certainly feels sometimes as if this is the definition of causation that's being endorsed in a lot of works. And I want to criticize this as also not an adequate definition. And for that, I'm going to use the example of something called the Vernon cipher. But actually, before I do that, let me just pause and see if there's any questions about do conditionals before we move on and how they're defined.
Could you tell us why you are calling these actual world and counterfactual?
Yeah. So the idea is we're imagining that in the real world, this is what's causally going on, that, for example, men and women sought out this treatment at different rates. And so the distribution we've observed over treatment recovery and gender is impacted by this. And the idea is that we try to define a notion, a mathematical object called the do conditional, by appealing to counterfactuals. It's the definition of do conditional is, you can think of it this way, it's what you would have observed if you'd done a randomized controlled trial. So if the treatment had been chosen at random by a coin flip rather than being influenced by any confounders with the recovery, this is the conditional probability of recovery given treatment you would have seen in that possible world. And the important thing in the discussion of Simpson's paradox is that if you look at the expression for this do conditional in this example, it's given by P of R given TG, P of G. These are things I can compute from just the joint distribution over these three variables in the real world. These expressions are the same in the real world and the counterfactual world. So the marginal over gender, we imagine to be the same in this world here. The way that recovery depends on treatment and gender is the same here in this world as it is in this. So I can extract these quantities from the actual distribution I observed over the three variables and then plug them into this formula to compute the do conditional, even though I haven't done a randomized control trial. So this is why it's sometimes possible to figure out what you're interested in, even though you haven't done the appropriate experiment. You can just use the observational data to figure it out. Did that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. So yeah, I want to criticize the idea that the do conditional, the non-triviality of a do conditional might be a good definition of A causing B. And so I'm going to use this Vernum cipher, which is also sometimes called the one-time pad. And the idea is that you have a plain text, which you're going, and a key, and you're basically going to add the plain text and the key together, mod two. So imagine that they're bits. You add them together, mod two, to get the ciphertext. And you've chosen the key at random. So the key variable is equally likely to be zero or one for a given bit. And so this has information theoretic security, because if the eavesdropper intercepts the ciphertext and asks, but you know, what are the likelihoods that the plain text bit was either zero or one for a given value of the ciphertext? The answer is it's equally likely to have been either value, because the key is equally likely to have been either zero or one. So you get no information about what the plain text was through this kind of encoding. Okay, so if you consider, you know, the causal structure, well, the ciphertext is being influenced by the plain text and the key because it's given by a formula in terms of the pair of them. And if you compute the do conditional, so I want to know what's the conditional probability of C given do T. So this is, essentially, you know, if this was the right way to define the causal influence of T on C, then it would ask me to go compute C given do T and compare it to just the marginal on C. And the point is that even if I set T, the treatment variable, to be, you know, zero or one, the distribution over the ciphertext is always uniform. As I toggle this treatment variable, the distribution of the ciphertext doesn't change. It's still the uniform distribution, because when I add something that's uniformly distributed to a bit, I get a uniform distribution, regardless of the value of that bit. So I'm going to get this uniform distribution over the ciphertext, regardless of how I've set the treatment variable. And so if we were using this definition of A causing B, we'd have to conclude that the treatment doesn't influence the ciphertext. But that's, I should say plain text, not treatment, sorry. The plain text T does not influence the ciphertext. And that's clearly the wrong conclusion, because the plain text obviously does influence the ciphertext. If it didn't, then I couldn't explain the fact that I could decode the plain text from the ciphertext, right? So causally, what does the decoding look like? So let D be the decoded text. I just make D equal to the ciphertext plus the key mod two, and that essentially gets me back to the plain text. And so the only way to explain the fact that the decoded text can recover the plain text is if the plain text had some causal influence on the ciphertext, right? There's no way that without any causal influence here, I could make sense of this. So in other words, this notion that we had back here of just looking at the do conditional can't possibly be the definition of causation, because it can't capture the fact that in the Vernum cipher, the plain text clearly is a cause of the ciphertext. So is that clear? Yep. Okay. Okay, so I want to, through the course of the lecture, try to persuade you what definition we should take for causation. And really, I would say what's problematic with the definitions we've seen up till now is that they basically include notions of probability in them. And the idea is going to be, actually, we need to completely separate probability from causation. And we need to take probabilities to be purely degrees of belief of agents, right? So purely epistemic, nothing to do with what's happening in the real world. And causal relationships are all our facts about the world. So we really need to find a definition of causation that has nothing to do with probabilities, and then figure out how we can access those causal relationships from the probabilistic data that we do have. So that's, and a lot of this lecture is gonna be sort of building up some concepts that we're gonna need later in the course. Okay, so I'm gonna start by going through some inferential concepts, and then I'll pass on to causal concepts, and then I'll essentially mix the two. So let's talk about what an inferential theory is. So one theory of inference would be Boolean propositional logic, but it's not the one that we're going to really need today, because most of the inferences that we're going to be talking about here are probabilistic. So appropriate theory is Bayesian probability theory. So let me start by reviewing some of the basics of Bayesian probability theory. I don't know what everybody's background is, but I presume that some of this will be familiar to a lot of you. So in that case, consider this maybe an introduction to the notation that's going to be used. So A is going to be some variable, and I'm also going to use something like A, you know, the name of the variable, to denote the set of that variable's values. So I'm just going to use that one notation for both purposes. So when I write capital P sub A, I mean a probability distribution over the set of values of that variable. So it's a map from the set A to the reals. And for every value in the set, obviously the probability assigned to it has to be between 0 and 1. And if I sum over the values, I have to get 1. Okay. Sometimes we're going to need to talk about the set of all distributions over some variable. So I'll write that as calligraphic notation. And often we're going to want to think of this distribution as defining a vector in some vector space over the reals. So if this notation here denotes the cardinality of the set A, then it's just a vector space of dimension equal to that cardinality. And the components of the vector are just the probabilities for the different values of A up to its maximum value. Okay, I'm also gonna often want to write this kind of thing, the square bracket notation. It's just another way of writing a Kronecker delta, essentially. So if I want to say, consider the distribution, the point distribution corresponding to A taking the value 0, then I'll write it like this. And that makes a lot of equations look a bit more like quantum states, expressions for quantum states, and makes the comparison to quantum theory a little bit easier. Okay, so say we have an A variable that's just binary, then in that case, the distribution defines a vector in a two-dimensional space. So if I choose as basis vectors, you know, the components, the probability of A being 0 and 1, then the normalization of the probability distribution means I can achieve any vector that's on this line. So I'm ranging here from A definitely being 0 to A definitely being 1. And in between, I have, you know, different relative probabilities of 0 and 1. And if I just look at sort of that the intrinsic space that this defines, you know, over here, I have just the point distribution on 0, the point distribution on 1. And then, you know, the closer I am to 1, the larger the weight of 1 in the mixture of the two. So I can think of that, you know, outside of the vector space as just a simplex of possibilities for the probability distributions on A. And so if I have, say, a three-valued A, 0, 1, and 2, this is the simplex of probability distribution. So the normalization condition takes me to this plane. Now, you know, obviously the vertices are these point distributions, and every point in the middle is some, you know, mixture of those vertices. And then finally, for a four-valued variable, it becomes a bit difficult to picture because I have this four-dimensional space. I think I've actually forgotten an axis. No, yeah, I have four axes, 1, 2, 3, 4. So I've just tried to depict a four-dimensional space. And then the plane, the hyperplane corresponding to normalized probability distributions becomes a tetrahedron in that four-dimensional space. So it's this, its intrinsic geometry is the geometry of the tetrahedron. And so the vertices of the tetrahedron are the point distributions, points inside are mixtures, these guys. So at various points, it's going to be useful to have these kinds of geometric intuitions about the space of probability distributions. Let me talk a bit about joint probability distributions now. So if I have a pair of variables A and B, then the joint distribution is just now a map from the Cartesian product of the set A and the set B to the reals. Obviously, they have to be positive, sum to 1. I can often talk about the set of all distributions. And now, when I represent this thing as a vector, it's a vector in the tensor product of the vector spaces corresponding to distributions on A and distributions on B. And so its components are just, you know, the probabilities for all the different possible combinations. And so, you know, if I have two bits, for example, then that's just a four-valued variable. So again, it's just this space corresponding to the tetrahedron. So I can plot probability distributions over two bits inside this tetrahedron. An important concept is marginalization. So the marginal distribution on A for some joint distribution on AB is just what you get if you sum over the different values of B in the joint distribution. So for every value of A, you sum up all the probabilities for any value of B to get the marginal on A. And the process of marginalizing over B, which I'll just denote this sum capital B, is the map that takes the joint distribution to the marginal. So I'm often going to use this kind of shorthand notation and not specify the values. Okay, so I thought it'd be cute just to say a little bit about what this marginalization procedure looks like geometrically. So the probability of A taking the value zero is just the sum of the joint probabilities of 0, 0, and 0, 1 for A and B. So I can think of it as this direction in the vector space. So essentially, if I want to know how much probability there is assigned to zero, I should ask about essentially a projection along that direction. So the planes that I'm drawing here are essentially the intersection of the three-dimensional space that's orthogonal to, remember, it's a four-dimensional space. So the three-dimensional space that's orthogonal to this direction, intersected with the simplex, the tetrahedron, gives me these two-dimensional planes. And so as I move from one side of the tetrahedron to the other, I'm going from the set of all distributions over AB that have, for example, here, you know, marginal on A assigning probably 3/4 to zero. And this is the case to assign 1/2, 1/4. And then down here, these are the ones that A is definitely one. So it assigns probability zero to value zero. And over here, it's assigning probability one to value zero. So I can recover things like marginals in this geometric picture as well. Good, and I can think, of course, in terms of just these other notation of distributions if I want. Okay, this is not so different. I mean, maybe it's a bit more intuitive if we talk about coarse grading. So if I ask what's the, in a three-valued variable, if I ask what's the probability of taking values either zero or one, that's just the sum of these two probabilities corresponds to this sort of direction. And then it's the same thing. I just take the two-dimensional planes that are orthogonal to this direction and intersect them with this triangle simplex, I'll get these specific lines. So it's the same thing in the case of marginalization. Okay. Conditional probability distributions are like joint distributions. They're the same kind of object. They're a map from the Cartesian product of the sets to the reals. Obviously, they're positive, but now they're normalized in the following sense, that for every value of B, the sum over A gives me one. So it just needs to define a distribution over A for each value of B. It doesn't have to be that when I sum over B, I get one. So if I have a joint distribution, AB, I can compute the marginal on B. I can take its inverse. So that means that wherever P of B is non-zero, take its inverse. And that defines the conditional A given B for that joint distribution. Let me just mention that when I write down expressions like that one, where I'm sort of multiplying some functions which have different subscripts, I just mean that, you know, for all the values of those variables, the function on the left is the product of the functions on the right evaluated at those values. So that's just what I mean by that product notation for the functions. Okay, so I can define the conditional, and then I can, I guess I should note that, you know, this is only well-defined for those values of B where the probability is greater than zero, because otherwise I can't invert it, but that's fine. This is sort of the standard thing. You just define the conditionals for those values. And you can easily verify that this formula does indeed give you a valid conditional probability. Because if I look at the definition, right, it's the joint over the marginal. That marginal on B can be written as the sum over A. And so now it's clear these things are all between 0 and 1. And if I sum them over A, I get 1. Okay, I can compute the joint from the marginal. I can compute the joint from the conditional and the marginal in the usual way. I'll just multiply both sides now by the marginal on B. And now note that we're often going to make use of these kinds of decompositions of a joint distribution over many variables. So if I have, say, five variables, A, B, C, D, E, I can write it as A given the rest, times B given the rest, times C given the rest, and so on. For any ordering of A, B, C, D, E, I can do this. So there's lots of decompositions like this. And, you know, the proof is straightforward. I first just use the relation between the joint, the conditional, and the marginal, where I've sort of lumped together B, C, D, and E. And then I re-express this piece in the same way, but now it's B that's partitioned from C, D, and A, and so on. Okay, so there's nothing causal about this kind of decomposition. You know, when you see a probability written down this way, it doesn't mean that B, C, D, and E are causes of A or anything like that. This is just a generic thing you can do to any probability distribution for any ordering of the variables. Okay, and now the reason conditional probabilities are significant is because you can use them to do Bayesian inversion. So this is Bayes' formula. The proof of Bayes' formula is pretty straightforward. I write down the expression for the joint in terms of the A given B conditional, and in terms of the B given A conditional, I set them equal to one another, and I immediately get that expression. And so the significance of Bayes' formula is that you can now, you know, use it to make inferences about hypotheses from data. So people sometimes struggle with probabilistic reasoning. So I want to give a simple example of the surprising results, I guess, that Bayes' theorem sometimes leads you to. So this is an example where you imagine that there's some test for a disease, like maybe it's a test for COVID, for example. So I'm going to just denote the disease variable, you know, either you don't have it or you do. And then the test variable, the test is either positive or it's negative. So imagine the accuracy of the test is 95%, meaning for anyone who has the disease, the probability they'll get a positive result when they take the test is 95%. And the false positive rate is just 2%, meaning for anyone who does not have the disease, the likelihood they'll get a positive test result is only 2%. So here's my question to you. Suppose you get a positive result. What probability should you assign to having the disease? Do they want to try, volunteer, or guess? I'm not sure if anyone's trying to speak, and I'm not hearing anything. I assume it's just silence over there. Oh, I'm somebody's saying something, but I can't hear it at all. Sorry. Could you try saying it again? No, I really can't hear anything from that end. Okay, well, I apologize that I can't hear, but I'll continue, and maybe wave your hand if you want me to stop, and I'll find out that way. So it was a trick question because you don't have all the data you need to solve this problem. So this is the form of Bayesian formula for this case. So you're interested in the conditional probability that someone has the disease given that they got a positive test result. So you want to know the disease given test result. You have the conditional probability of test result given disease. That's, you know, positive test result for each of these conditions. But you haven't been told what the prior probability for the disease is. So that's the extra information you need. So if you imagine that the base rate for this particular illness is say 1 in 10,000, you can plug all these numbers into this formula and get your answer. So this is, excuse me, this is the formula for the probability you have disease given that you got the positive test result. The probability that the prior probability of getting a positive test result overall is just the sum of the probability of getting a positive test result if you have the disease times the probability you have the disease plus the probability of getting the positive test result given that you didn't times the probability you didn't. If you plug in these numbers, this is what you get. So up in the numerator, you have this very small prior probability of having the disease that impacts this probability of testing positive given that you have the disease. Now in the denominator, basically dominated by the second term, the disease is sufficiently rare that basically the denominator is just almost 0.02. So really what you have to do is you just have to take the ratio of this accuracy over the false positive rate times the prior, the base rate to figure out your posterior. So this is about 50. And so at the end of the day, this is the probability you have the disease, is about 0.5%. So even though false positive rate is very low and the accuracy of the test is very high, the fact that the disease is very rare means that when you get a positive result, it's more likely it's that you're one of the many, many people who doesn't have the disease who happens to have got unlucky and a false positive than one of the very, very few people who has it, but would probably get a positive result if they did. Okay, so this, these kinds of examples are usually what's used to argue in favor of the sort of importance of, doing Bayesian probability theory correctly, because a lot of, medical practitioners and policymakers in legal cases and all over the place that don't use this sort of reasoning and therefore, make poor judgments. All right. Two notions that are going to be really important for causal inference are marginal and conditional independence. So let's move on to those definitions. So variables A and B are marginally independent if any of the following equivalent conditions holds. So the joint factorizes, or the conditional B given A is just equal to the marginal on B, or the conditional A given B is equal to the marginal on A. So you can easily show that these are equivalent because, if you think about the definition of the conditional B given A, it just asks me to take the joint and divide by the marginal on A. So if I do that, I get P of B, similarly for the other ones. And each of these equations, as I said, they're equivalent, but they can be sort of read in different ways. Like you might read the bottom one as follows. You say something like, learning B teaches you nothing new about A. So, once you've learned the value of B, your state of knowledge about A will be the same as when you didn't know the value of B. This one says, learning A teaches you nothing about B. I think I might've said this one backwards. And then this one here says that your joint knowledge just splits off into independent knowledge of A and B. We're often going to need a shorthand for this. So there's a notation in causal inference, which is a symbol that usually has two vertical bars, but I wasn't able to reproduce that. So I'm just using one vertical bar, but it's kind of a perpendicular symbol, which means marginal independence. So you're going to see this popping up a lot in the course. And now let me just note what this kind of constraint looks like in terms of constraints on the joint distribution itself. So it's effectively a set of polynomial equality constraints. So I'm taking that first equation here, and I'm writing down a version of it for every possible pair of values of A and B. And then I've rewritten the probability of A being little a explicitly in terms of the joint, right? So I'm summing over the values of B to get just the marginal probability of the value little a. And similarly over here, I'm summing over A to get just the marginal probability of B. So this you can think of, remember that these different real numbers here, the different probabilities, are what sort of define, where I am in that vector space. And so this basically is a polynomial equality that constrains this joint distribution. And so it's going to be like a submanifold relative to all of the distributions, because they have to satisfy this equality. So for example, you know, in the case where A and B are both binaries, so that I can draw it in this tetrahedron, this polynomial equality ends up being this fan shape. So this fan describes the subset of all distributions on binary A and binary B that have the form of some distribution on A multiplied by some distribution on B. So like over here, for example, I have A is definitely zero, and I have any old mixture of any mixture of probabilities for zero and one on B. Over here, A is one, and in between, I have some mixture of zero and one for A and some mixture of zero and one for B. Okay, so we're gonna see pictures like this later in the course. The point is that it's in the language of algebraic geometry, these polynomial equalities are picking out an algebraic variety that your probability distributions have to live on. Okay, the more important notion is not marginal independence, but conditional independence. So again, these are three equivalent statements of conditional independence. So A and B, conditionally independent given C. And they look just like the marginal independence ones, but now everywhere, every expression has been conditioned on C. And so again, you can think of this as follows. In the context of already knowing C, because on both sides of this equation, there's a conditioning on C. So in the context of already knowing C, learning B teaches you nothing new about A. So the what I believe about A given B and C is the same as what I believed about A given C alone. And this equation here is, in the context of already knowing C, learning A teaches me nothing new about B. And this basically says, in the context of knowing C, the joint distribution on A and B factorizes. So A and B may not factorize on its own, but conditioned on C, it does. And this gets denoted, you know, A perpendicular to B given C in the rest of the course. I can also express this as a set of polynomial equality constraints on the joint distribution over ABC. So if you take that, let's see, how have I done it here? I'm marginalizing. This is, I've rewritten these things as the joint on ABC. So imagine taking this first equation, multiplying by the marginal on C, I'll get joint over ABC. And then I would need to multiply the right-hand side by two marginals on C to get a joint on AC and BC. So take the whole first equation, multiply by PC squared, you'll get PABC, PC, this is PAC, this is PBC. Anyway, so it's a polynomial equality on the parameters that show up in the joint distribution over the three variables. And because I can't easily depict an eight-dimensional space of probability distributions, I'm not going to try to give you a picture of this, but it's going to define some algebraic variety in that eight-dimensional space of probability distributions. Okay, we're almost at the end of discussing things that are about inference. There's something called the semigraphoid axioms, which are inferences you can make just based on conditional independence relations. So without knowing anything about the details of the probability distribution, if you have certain kinds of conditional independences, you know that others hold as well. So the first one is trivial. If I tell you that X is independent of Y given Z, well then Y is independent of X given Z. That's sort of obvious from the definition being symmetric under exchange of A and B. But they're all actually very intuitive. I mean, you can prove them based on the definition, but I'll just give you the intuitive version. So this second axiom called decomposition says that, you know, over here on the left, it says, in the context of already knowing Z, learning Y and W teaches you nothing new about X. Well, that means that if instead of learning Y and W, you just learned Y, so you learned less. Well, clearly that's not going to teach you about X either. You know, if learning Y and W teaches nothing about X, then just learning Y won't teach you about X. Okay, this one here, if in the context of already knowing Z, learning Y and W teaches you nothing new about X, then if you instead had already known W, so if W is part of the background information in addition to Z, and then you learned Y, you also wouldn't learn anything about X. So basically this says that it doesn't matter with whether W is considered something new that I've learned or something that was part of my background information. And then this one here says that if, you know, in the context of knowing Z, learning Y teaches me nothing new about X. And in the context of knowing Z and Y, learning W teaches me nothing new about X. Then if I imagine that I know Z already and I learned W and Y, I'm not going to learn anything new about X. So the idea here is that I could have learned Y rather than have it as part of the background information. When you tell me that, you know, learning Y will teach me nothing new about X, I can sort of combine these two into this form. Okay, so generally it means that if you figure out all the conditional independence relations that hold in some distribution, you can summarize them by a generating set and then kind of expand it under these axioms. So it's useful sometimes to say, okay, here's just a generating set of conditional independence relations. It's not all of them, but you can infer any other from these. Good. Okay, so in the next lecture, probably we're going to do a deep dive in terms of, you know, what conditional independence relations among variables imply for the causal structure that could have given rise to them. And so that's where semigraphoid axioms are going to come in handy. Let me just mention one other thing that's going to come up later in the course, which is clearly on the inferential side, nothing to do with causation. And that's what's called the marginal problem. So the marginal problem has the following flavor. I tell you something about certain marginals of a distribution. So in this example, there's three variables, A, B, C. And suppose I tell you what the marginal on A, B is, the marginal on A, C, and the marginal on B, C. And they're these ones. So, you know, A and B are perfectly correlated. They're all bits in this example. A and C are perfectly correlated. B and C are perfectly correlated. The marginal problem asks, can you find a joint distribution over all three variables that has exactly these marginals? So in this case, the answer is yes. The joint distribution where it's probability half all are zero and probability half all are one. If I compute the marginal on any pair of systems here, I'll find perfect correlations. I'll reproduce these guys. But that's not true for every set of marginals. So here's an example, a triple of pairwise marginals for which there's no joint distribution that yields these. So yes?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That was not a question.
That was not a question. It's the echo of my voice. I see. I think
we're going to have to
do something about that. Let's see. Are you hearing me twice? Oh, okay, now it's better. Okay, good. Thanks. Right. So if A and B are anticorrelated, A and C are anticorrelated, B and C are anticorrelated, there's no joint distribution that gives that, because any joint distribution over all three will have to be made up of a mixture of the possible bit strings that are three elements long. So 0, 0, 0. 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, et cetera, all the way up to 1, 1, 1. But if you look at any one of those bit strings, you'll always see that, you know, maybe two of the pairs are anticorrelated, but there's always one pair that's correlated in every one of those eight strings. So there's no way that you're going to get this pattern. Okay, so again, the marginal problem is entirely to do with probability distribution, nothing to do with causal relations. So we're gonna see that later on. And maybe just more generally, I would say that probability theory should really be thought of as kind of part of a theory of sort of how to make good decisions in the presence of incomplete information. It's more of a normative thing. Like, if you don't want to lose money, you know, gambling, then you should reason in this way. It's not really a theory about the world at all. And in particular, I can talk about a conditional probability of something in the future given something in the past. That's what we normally do. But I can also talk about the probability, you know, what do I believe about the past given some fact that I observe today? So what probability do I assign to dinosaurs having roamed the earth given that today I observe some fossils? Probability theory doesn't care about the causal relations between variables. You use the same formulas regardless of what the causal relations are. So it's really neutral to causal structure. And in fact, it can even be used in cases like, you know, I might want to assign a probability to some mathematical truth being true. Nothing to do with physics at all. So it's useful to keep that in mind that at least in this course, you know, the probability theory is really going to be treated entirely as something used by rational agents to reason about uncertainty. And probabilities just represent degrees of belief. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of concepts that should be over here on the inferential side. And now let's move on to, you know, what can we say is causation, what are causal concepts? So again, just some examples to get us sort of thinking. So this is a famous example from Gregory Salmon about, who's a philosopher, about essentially like the kind of point we made before regarding the difference between inference and causation, that there's a relationship between the height of a flagpole and the length of its shadow. You can write it this way, but I can also write it this way. You know, so there's lots of ways of writing that equation. And as physicists, we tend to not care how the equation is written. I can organize it any way I like. They're all equivalent statements. But if I'm committed to the idea that these are all equivalent statements, then I'm really only making an inferential statement. What all these equations are telling me is that if you give me this data, then I can make an inference about the data that's missing. So, you know, this top equation here tells me that, you know, if you tell me the length of the flagpole and the length of the shadow, I can infer the angle. But there'll be another equation that will allow me to infer the length of the flagpole from the angle and the shadow, and so on. They're not causal. They're really just about inferences. If I want to express a causal relationship, the fact that it's the length of the flagpole that causes the length of the shadow, I have to use some mathematical representation that actually captures the asymmetry. So like an equation, which I can rewrite any way I like, won't do, but I can use a directed acyclic graph, or as I'm gonna do in most of this lecture, a kind of circuit diagram where the output of the circuit is the variable, which is the length of the shadow, and the inputs are the angle, and the length of the flagpole. And so this really says that, you know, it's this counterfactual idea that, you know, if I were to imagine a world where I changed the length of the shadow by, you know, I don't know, shining a bright light on some part of it, that's not going to change, you know, the length of the flagpole would not thereby be changed. But if I imagine a world where the length of the flagpole is changed, then the length of the shadow gets changed. Anyway, so we need to go beyond sort of our usual equations to express causal relations. We need to introduce an asymmetry into our equations. And so that's why we use directed acyclic graphs where the directed edges are asymmetric, or these circuit diagrams where there's sort of an asymmetry between, you know, things that are inputs and things that are outputs. So you can find the same thing everywhere in physics, really. Like if you look at Newton's second law, we can write it any way we like, you know, F is equal to ma is the conventional way, but all these equations are really saying is that if you give me two of these pieces of data, I can infer the third. They're not expressing a causal relation. The causal relation is clearly that the acceleration is determined by the force applied in the mass. That's the causal relation. The force does not get determined by the acceleration causally. It's the other way around. Or, you know, the law of projectile motion, which says, you know, what height a projectile will rise to given a certain initial angle, certain initial velocity. Again, that's, you know, this is the causal relation between them, even though I can rewrite this equation any way I like. So this is why it's sort of important to introduce some asymmetry into the mathematical representation. And now the important thing here is that once you've figured out which of the many functions corresponds to the causal direction, so here it's, you know, this form of the equation, this is really describing everything there is to know about how the height depends on these causal parents. And the key thing is that it's not just telling you what the height will be for the particular initial conditions that held in your actual experiment. It's telling you about every possible world. If the initial conditions had been different in any way, this is what, you know, this function tells you exactly what the height would have been. So when you stipulate a functional dependence, you're really making a statement about all these counterfactuals. So in other words, these causal relations or causal laws, they really allow you to make inferences about counterfactuals. That's the key. You can reason about all the scenarios that might occur. Okay, so I'm gonna say more about sort of what this circuit representation means for describing, you know, causal structure. The general pattern is that we're gonna have, you know, wires that represent variables, okay? And these are abstract representations. I'm not imagining an actual circuit. So like the examples we just saw, these are abstract representations of different variables. And then these gates in the representation are functions. So they're, you know, they stipulate the values of the outcome, the output variable for every possible choice of values of the input variables for that gate. So essentially the sets of values for each of the variables, that's like the kinematics of the theory. And these functions are essentially like dynamical laws. And the idea that, you know, the causal structure is really a stipulation of those functional dependences. Okay, so if X and Y are the input and output, then, you know, the function that takes set X to the set Y is really what describes the causal relationship. Everything there is to say about the causal relationship between X and Y is said by that function. It tells you not only what actually happened, but what would have happened for any other value of X. Okay, I can of course have more than just one causal parent. I could have, say, X and Z as causal parents of Y. So I would just draw that as a gate with multiple inputs. And now when I have multiple inputs, I can ask, even though I've drawn this gate, does it really represent a non-trivial causal influence of some variable like X on Y? You know, this function could, after all, be a trivial function. It's just, that's Y to some value. So it's nice to have a definition of when X actually influences Y and when it doesn't. So we'll say X has no influence on Y if the function F that determines Y from all of its causal parents has a trivial dependence on X, right? So in that case, you tell me the function that determines Y, I can immediately say whether X influences Y or not just by looking at whether that function depends on X non-trivially. Okay, so if I wanted to draw that, I would say, like, if I have this function that depends on X and Z, but, you know, really Y only depends on Z through some function G and not on X at all. So we use this little ground symbol from electronics to mean that we're essentially not using X. Or, you know, as an equation, if F of X and Z is just G of Z, then X does not influence Y. And, you know, to define non-trivial influence, it's just the opposite, that this function should be such that Y has a non-trivial dependence on X. So if this thing, this equality I wrote in the last slide fails to hold, then you have a non-trivial influence. Good, and so that's it. That's the definition that I think is the correct one for classical purposes. And now we can just talk about, you know, some consequences of this definition. So it can happen. Yes, go ahead.
All of this looks a lot like symmetric monoidal categories.
Yeah.
Is that exactly what you're doing here? Okay.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I am essentially using the same kind of diagrammatic formalism that people use to describe equations in symmetric monoidal categories to describe causal structures. Yeah, and in a lot of recent work, people have been trying to replace some of the formalism that gets used in the causal inference community, which is mostly directed acyclic graphs, with string diagrams instead, and to formalize certain results as, you know, string diagram rewrite rules. So I find the diagrams very useful for kind of making things a bit more pedagogical. And so I'm going to use them mostly in that respect. I'm not going to try to develop a kind of formal mathematical framework in terms of them. But yeah, you're definitely thinking correctly when you think about symmetric monoidal categories. It's the same kind of diagrams, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so take this example here where I have a pair of systems, A1, A2. They go through a gate and become B1, B2, go through another gate, C1, C2, another gate, D1, D2. One kind of question I can ask is not just, you know, does A1 influence B1 and B2, but does A1 have an influence on D1? Does A1 have an influence on D2? What's the effective causal influence of the inputs on the final outputs? And so in this example, I'm using C0s. So this is a C0 with A1 as the control, A2 is the target. This C0 is reversed, so B2 is the control, B1 is the target. This one's reversed again. And so it's a well-known fact that three classical controlled knots in this kind of sequence just gives me a swap gate. So it can happen. So ultimately, if I work out, you know, what the composition of these three functions are, I get some overall function between the A's and the D's, which in this case is just the swap gate. And then I just ask, okay, in this overall function, is D1 a non-trivial function of A1? And the answer comes back, no, it doesn't depend at all on A1. Therefore, A1 doesn't influence D1. Is D1 a non-trivial function of A2? Yes, D1 is actually equal to A2. So A2 has an influence on D1. So I can use this functional definitional causation to settle questions of causal influence, yeah, even though they might be between inputs and outputs that are separated by a long sequence of circuit elements. All right, now how do you represent some variable that influences more than one other variable? And so in this kind of circuit diagram, I need an extra element to that, which is a copy operation. So if B and C are both influenced by A, then I can think of that as follows. I take A, I make two copies of A. One copy gets, it becomes the input of a function that determines B. The other copy becomes the input of a function that determines C. So for example, if you know Bob and Charlie have some probability of taking an umbrella when they leave their house based on the weather forecast, then you know that there might be correlations between, you know, when they take the days on which they both take umbrellas, right? So there's a correlation in their umbrella taking behavior. The common cause is the weather forecast. And so there it's sort of clear that they each get a copy of the same weather forecast because that weather forecast was broadcast to each of them. So they're each responding to a different copy of that same information. But generically, that's what happens when you have a common cause. You have some degree of freedom that ultimately being copied and influencing many different degrees of freedom. And so formally, this little dot copy operation, which is also very familiar from anyone who looks at symmetric monoidal category stuff, that's just a map from A to two copies of A, which takes a particular value to just a pair of those values. Okay, so I've basically, this part of the talk used only these circuits and not the DAGs that directed acyclic graphs that I talked about yesterday in the beginning of this lecture. I want to say a little bit about how you translate between those two. So they're really representing the same kind of information, a causal structure. The nodes in the DAG go over to wires in this string diagram. So you know, the node Y becomes a wire that's output from some box. The node X becomes a wire that's output from some box. And then all the arrows leading into a node just stipulate which other variables are going to become input. So which of the wires should be input into that gate. So if X influences Y and influences something else, then I have to make a copy of X, feed one copy into the input of Y. Similarly with Z, I need to feed one copy into the input of this gate. And then these copies can go off and influence other things. You know, if various things influence X, well, then there has to be a wire that feeds into X corresponding to that other variable. These copy operations can have, of course, more than two copies. You could have one variable influencing three, four, five others. So you just make more copies. And so that's how you would represent exactly the same information in a circuit form. So In other words, you know, this distinction is really just a conventional one as to whether you want to represent a causal structure as a circuit or as a DAG. But I should mention that, like, when you look at the causal inference literature, DAGs get used for many purposes, and the typical, when people typically write down DAGs, they don't mean to say that Y depends deterministically on its parents. They sort of allow for some other variables that are not stipulated as nodes in the DAG that Y could depend on. Whereas what I've been doing and what I will be doing is imagining circuits where the gates in the circuits really are deterministic dependencies. They're functions. They're not conditional probabilities. And so so when I use a circuit, you should sort of remember that these are all deterministic functions. I could have used a DAG for that, but then it would be quite confusing because that's not the typical way that DAGs get used. Okay. excuse me. So there's a notion in the causal inference framework of something that gets called causal autonomy. And it's this. So suppose that the function that maps A and B to C and D has the following form. A gets copied, B gets copied, and then C gets determined by some function of A and B, D gets determined by some function of A and B. The idea of autonomy is that these functions, F and G, basically can be varied independently. But, you know, what it means for C to be causally determined by its parents and D to be causally determined by its parents, I can really vary the nature of those dependencies as I like, right? So there's no sense in which my choice of F narrows down the options for my choice of G. I think in the context in which causal inference usually gets used, so epidemiology, economics, things like that, that's a totally reasonable assumption to make. If you're starting to say that, oh, G is constrained relative to F, it usually means that it's because there's some common cause and you should be incorporating that common cause into your model. But in physics, this causal autonomy sometimes fails. So in particular, if I think of Hamiltonian dynamics or symplectic dynamics, generally when I have these sort of two-to-two interactions, it's not the case that I can choose the way that C depends on these guys totally independently of the way D depends on these guys. Or more generally, in the case of conservation laws, if C is, you know, carrying away a certain amount of a conserved quantity, then D can only carry away the remainder, can't carry away an arbitrary amount. So in other words, in physics, often you have these sort of intrinsic two-to-two interactions that can't really be broken up in this way where F and G are allowed to be specified independently. And this kind of feature is not really going to come up much in the rest of the course. Although, you know, in the quantum case, there's an analog of the fact that you can't typically do this. In the quantum case, we're going to see that you don't have a copy operation because of the no cloning theorem. And you know, it would be more important that these things can't be split up in this way. Okay, another important distinction among types of causal influences are direct versus indirect causal influences. So if there's a function that determines Y from X, then you say, and you know, the variables I'm considering are just X and Y, well, then X has a direct influence on Y. But if the set of variables I have in mind includes Z, and Z is a mediary, right? So there's a function from X to Z and Z to Y. Then we say, okay, that's an indirect influence of X and Y. And of course, I can have both of them acting together, right? A copy of X is made, and one of these copies, you know, leapfrogs over here and influences G directly. So notice, therefore, that it's kind of not enough to just tell me, you know, whether or not X influences Y. It's important whether it's a direct or an indirect influence. So, you know, here, if I intervened on Z or learnt Z, there could still be correlations between X and Y by virtue of this indirect pathway. And some approaches to causation kind of are more concerned about possibility of causing. So like when we're talking about relativistic notions of causation, where I want to know whether X and Y are events where X is in the backward light cone of Y, there you have a kind of transitivity. If all you care about is, you know, is it possible for X to influence Y? Well, if it's possible for X to influence Z and for Z to influence Y, then yes, it's possible for X to influence Y. But here we have in mind a different kind of notion, a sort of, it's not just the possibility of influence. It's, we're talking about, you know, actual direct influence. And so we can have situations where X does not influence Y directly, it only influences Y via Z. And other cases where, you know, it does influence Y directly in addition to influencing it via Z. So here, those are important distinctions. Okay. So far, I haven't said anything about preparation of the system, but I can always prepare some variable like A. I can think of, I'm going to draw it as a little triangle with say like a little a in it, which means I have prepared the variable A to take value little a. And I can think of this as, you know, just preparing a physical state of A. This can be thought of as just a gate which acts from sort of the trivial system to A, right? So it's the gate that just, you know, stipulates which value A takes. All right, so with all those bits of formalism, I can now describe the Vernon cipher example we talked about earlier, right? So if I say, okay, what's going on causally in this Vernon cipher? There's the plain text, there's a key which has been physically prepared to have some particular value, either 0 or 1, that's little k. The key and the plain text variables get summed mod 2, so that's this T O plus K notation here to give me the ciphertext. Another copy of the key goes over to the decoder. The decoded text is now the sum mod 2 of the key and the ciphertext. And all of this just gives me an identity map from the plain text to the decoded text. Right, so it doesn't matter whether the key took the value 0 or the value 1. If it took the value 0, then the ciphertext is equal to the plain text and the decoded text is equal to the ciphertext. If it took the value 1, then the ciphertext is just the negation of the plain text and the decoded text is the negation of the ciphertext, and I get back my identity. So that's just a statement about what's going on causally in the Vernon cipher. There's sort of two possibilities for K here, and in both cases, you get this identity channel. Okay. Now, notice that, you know, there's some variability for the possibilities of a function. So if X and Y are binary, and there's actually only 4 functions going to it. There's the identity, which takes X and gives me X. There's the flip function, which negates it. And then there's functions that are constant. So reset to 0 means whatever the value of X is, the output is 0, and reset to 1, whatever the value of X is, reset to 1. So those are the only 4 possibilities for this function from X to Y. And so something that's often useful is to imagine that instead of having a specific function in your circuit, you have a kind of generic sort of programmable function where I have a variable, I'll call it capital F, whose values are now just the possible functions from X to Y. And so I can stipulate that, okay, capital F takes the value some particular function. And then I can think of all this as just I control this function based on this value, and then I throw it away. So I'm just sort of programming a particular function. And in that way, I can represent, if I like, ignorance about what the function is in terms of ignorance of the value of this extra variable. So that's often useful to sort of shift between these two ways of talking about your ignorance of that functional dependence. So for example, if I just have some circuit with this causal structure and particular functions F, G, H, I can always rewrite that if I like as, you know, some extra variables, capital H, capital G, capital F, that are taking those particular values and controlling the function that acts on these wires. Good, okay, so on the causal side now, we've talked about causal structure, counterfactuals, direct versus indirect causes, this causal autonomy. These are all things that have nothing to do with anyone's knowledge. Everything I just told you about was like a description of what's happening regardless of what anyone knows. And that's what is distinctive of these causal concepts relative to these inferential concepts. Okay, so the final thing that we need to do now is just sort of combine these two things together. And really, I think the whole field of causal inference, it's fair to say, is ultimately dealing with, you know, the situation where you're trying to reason about causation, but you have uncertainty. In situations where there's no uncertainty, like in, you know, the law of projectile motion, life was easy and there was sort of no need to really have a big discussion about how do you infer causal connections. Like, you know, Galileo can work out laws of projectile motion without having to deal with probability theory at all. But most experiments do have some uncertainty, some statistics, and then you have to disentangle sort of your uncertain knowledge. You have to sort of try to figure out what's going on causally despite being uncertain about a number of parameters. So causal inference is really about disentangling those two things. Okay, so again, as a kind of aid, just sort of pictorial aid, when I talk about sort of the ignorance about X, some probability distribution of X, what's really handy is to sort of imagine my causal diagram in black here, and then I sort of hook on another diagram, which is now going horizontally, which is describing knowledge. So elements in this horizontal diagram are going to be things like probabilities, conditional probabilities. So I could say, all right, this little picture tells me, oh, I have some knowledge P of X about some physical system X. And, you know, if there's some function that takes X to Y, well, I might have some knowledge about what that function is. So there's some matter of fact in the real world about what the function is, but I might not know it. So I have some probability distribution over the possibilities. Now, of course, I could think of that knowledge, my probability distribution, as probability distribution over yet another variable, F, which programs the function from X to Y, if I like, and I can make it sort of all my knowledge pertain to variables rather than functions. But generally, I'm going to use this kind of shorthand notation. Okay, so now if I put these guys together, I have X prepared in some way, and then it goes through a function to Y. I can stipulate what I know about X and what I know about the function taking X to Y, right? That's a perfectly fine thing to do. Sometimes I might have even correlated knowledge about, what the preparation of X was and what the function that took X to Y was. But generally, we're going to assume that, you know, when we're analyzing physical systems and trying to figure out their causal structure, we're generally going to assume that the mechanism that fixes this function is independent from the mechanism that fixes X. So that's going to be a common assumption in a lot of these algorithms, that you start out with your prior information does not involve any correlation between independent causal mechanisms. Okay, so you might ask now, all right, if I have some knowledge of this function and some knowledge of X, what should I say I know about X and Y together? Like, how should I think about my joint distribution over X and Y in that circumstance? And so this is where the notation kind of comes in handy. Like, okay, I want to know, what do I know about X and Y? I could draw that this way. And so I could just sort of pull out these horizontal wires. And this is now a way of saying, look, I know this is what I think the causal structure is. X influences Y, X is prepared. This is what I know about the function. This is what I know about X. And I can use that to compute what the overall distribution over X and Y is, right? So I would just apply each function in this distribution to X and compute the value of Y and then weight those values with the probabilities. So here's a way of doing that. So this is the key part here, this formula. So if I want to know what's the conditional probability of Y given X, for instance, I just say, all right, well, Y is determined deterministically from X via function F, but I'm ignorant about which function it is, and I assign these relative probabilities to the different functions. So I sum over the possible functions with these relative weights and these Kronecker delta expressions to get the conditional probability of Y given X. And so one way to think about that diagrammatically is that I can split the X wire here and say, if X causes Y, then whatever I learn about X, that's what I know about how X is prepared. So I can sort of always think of this as just sort of a new preparation of X in the same preparation it had before, because whatever I know about this one, I know the same thing about that one. I can sort of copy this X here and say, that's what I know about this guy. And now this little part of the circuit, I can rewrite all of it this way as just the map that takes distributions on X to distributions on Y. And so effectively, the stipulations I make about the causal structure end up dictating something about my knowledge, right? So what I know about X and Y, I can decompose, in this case, the joint distribution into the marginal and the conditional based on the causal structure. And in more complicated examples, we'll see next time how, you know, there could be a lot of structure there in the distribution that reflects what's going on causally. Okay, so let's try to get back to where we started. Ultimately, as you know, according to the definition I propose, you know, the function f that relates x to y is everything there is to say about how x causes y. And so if you have some uncertainty about f represented by some distribution, then you basically said everything you can about that causal mechanism, right? So that's the high road, is just stipulating your probability distribution. And the tricky part is that what you can usually estimate from statistical data is this do conditional I talked about earlier, y given do x. And we just saw in the, we should have said y given do x here. We can compute that from this knowledge of the function, right? That the way x influences y in this conditional probability is just given by this distribution over functions. The problem is that there are many distributions over functions that correspond to the same do conditional. So let me give you, that's an important point. And so I'm gonna give you a simple example of that. Again, it's this bit-to-bit example. X and y are both binary. There's four functions. And now I want you to consider these two different states of knowledge. So one is you don't know whether the function's identity or flip, and the other is you don't know whether it's reset to zero or reset to one. And in both cases, you assign equal probabilities to the two options. So if you use this formula for computing the do conditional, so over here on the left, the representation of this deterministic identity function as a stochastic matrix is just the identity matrix. And the representation of the flip function as a stochastic matrix is just this guy here. If I sum those with equal probability, I get this map, which basically tells me whatever, regardless of the value of x, just output a random y. So this y given to x here, that's the randomizing channel. Now, if I go over here on the right, I start with this pair. The stochastic matrix that represents the constant function that outputs zero regardless of x is just this guy. This is the constant function that outputs one. If I sum those with equal weights, I again get the completely randomizing function. So the point is that these two extremely different probability distributions over functions have given me exactly the same do conditional. And these really are very different because here I have a lack of information as to whether it's identity or flip, but each of these functions involves a perfect causal connection between X and Y, right? For each of these functions, identity and flip, if I toggle X, Y toggles. And over here on the right, each of these functions involves no causal connection between X and Y. As I vary X, Y just stays the same here. So this knowledge has all of its support on functions that involve trivial dependence of Y on X. And over here, all of the support is on non-trivial dependence, and yet they give the same do conditional. So the do conditional has thrown away all that information that was contained in the distribution over functions. Good, so what it means is that we can't easily figure out what we want, this distribution over functions, from what causal inference usually gives us, which is this ways to evaluate this do conditional. And I would say typically people just settle for calculating the do conditional and they don't worry too much about the fact that it often has thrown away information. And I'm gonna show you, I mean, it's true that it's often extremely useful and we're gonna spend a lot of time talking about ways of computing the do conditional from observational data. But I thought it'd be useful to just point out that sometimes you can do better. Sometimes you can actually get at this distribution, the thing that you really want. And so I'll end with a discussion of that. So I have to start with, you know, how you get the do conditional from statistical data, because now we're talking about, you know, say we don't know the causal model exactly. We want to infer some of the parameters of the model from our observational data. How do we do that? So I'm going to start with just sort of a story about how we estimate Duke conditionals in simple circumstances. So let's say this is the causal structure, you know, just X causes Y, and then there's a copy of X around for me to observe. Okay, really what we have in any of these examples is a statistical ensemble. So what I mean is that we have a number of repetitions of this experiment many times over. And that's where we're drawing our data from. We're looking at relative frequencies in an ensemble of repetitions. That's where all the statistical data that we're going to make inferences based on comes from. And if I want, I can think of each of these as just a joint, it's preparing a joint distribution on X and Y in each case. So I've tried to sort of put these together into a triangle. So I have these n-fold repetition of some joint distribution on X and Y. And generally what we assume is that it's that my knowledge of these n systems is exchangeable. So meaning if somebody permuted any permutation of them, it wouldn't change my beliefs. So I think they're equivalent in that sense, that the particular ordering of them doesn't make a difference to any of the predictions I would make. And that should be true for all n. You know, no matter what n you choose, I would always assign a permutation invariant knowledge. Well, that's a well-known situation where the distribution I should now assign to all these variables has what's called definite form. So it's going to be essentially this IID source here. So the Qs are for the different X and Ys in each of these guys. And then some distribution over possibilities for that Q, that joint distribution on X and Y. So that's what the exchangeability guarantees me. And then often what happens is that if we take in enough data, then we can essentially learn, we can get that mu distribution here down to something like a point distribution. So we can basically characterize our statistical ensemble as the same distribution over X and Y, just n-fold repeated. Okay, so this is the IID source. So typically that's where we're working, where we trust that we understand things well enough that we have an IID source on our hands. And so that what we measure, what we estimate using relative frequencies, is this joint probability distribution that characterizes our IID source. Okay, so if you're in this very simple scenario where X causes Y and there's no confounder between them, there's nothing that acts as a common cause, well, then the Duke conditional is exactly the same as the regular conditional, right? When I learn X, it can't inform me about some common cause with Y. So basically, these are exactly the same. And so you can just compute the Duke conditional by, you know, estimating the joint, computing the conditional from that, and that is your Duke conditional. Okay, but now let's talk about how we could use observational data to estimate the probability distribution over the function rather than just the Duke conditional. So remember the Vernum cipher. Now I'm going to depict it as a circuit, but it's not a DAG anymore. I have the plain text, the key, our input into a function which computes the ciphertext just based on the sum mod 2 of the plain text and the key. The key has some particular value, 0 or 1 in the real world, but I don't know it, right? It's uniformly distributed. And you know, maybe I'm thinking of an IID version of this. Okay, so you know, as we mentioned before, you know, if I just compute C given due T, well, it's always the uniform distribution over C. So there's no nothing interesting going on with the due conditional. It's entirely trivial. So if I tried to define causation that way, I would say that T does not influence C, which is obviously the wrong answer in this case. But if we use the definition that I mentioned earlier, which is we say, okay, X has a non-trivial influence on Y, just in case the function that determines Y has a non-trivial dependence on X. So what do I want to do? I want to find the function F from T to C. Okay, so they let F be the effective function from T, the plain text, to see the ciphertext. In the Vernum cipher, I know that it's going to be a distribution over possibilities because there's a distribution over the values of the key, right? So if the key is 0, then the function from T to C is identity. If the key is 1, the function from T to C is flip. So if I don't know the key, if it's unobserved, then the most I can say about the functional relationship between T and C is that it's either identity or flip. So that's effectively the right answer in this case. You know, this just giving me the do conditional tells me very little. This is what you'd like to be able to say in this case. So then the question is there any way to infer that fact from observational data alone? And so in this example, you can. So you're going to leave K, the key, unobserved, and you're going to assume that you understand the causal structure, but you're not going to assume anything about the parameters, right? So here's that causal structure we drew, and I'm making copies of the ciphertext and the plain text. That's what these copy operations are. I'm allowing these distributions here, these probability distributions, to be arbitrary at this stage. They're things that I'm going to want to try to infer from what I see, the relative frequencies. So I imagine, getting statistics and discovering that the joint distribution on the plain text, the ciphertext, and the decoded text, that's D, is this. So I notice that the plain text and the decoded text are perfectly correlated with a uniform marginal on each. And the ciphertext is totally uncorrelated with them and uniformly distributed. That's what I observe. Okay, so I've drawn that here as like the joint distribution over these three guys is just, whatever was going on with some distributions here, and then I learn about them. Okay, so now here's how the argument goes. Again, F is going to be the function from T to C. G is now the function from C to D, the effective function from C to D. It turns out that the only way you're going to explain this data is if the joint distribution over F and G is this correlated distribution where both are identity or both are flip. Why is that? Well, you need to explain the fact that the decoded text tracks the plain text. Each one of these functions, there's only four possibilities, right? Identity, flip, reset to zero, reset to one. If either one of these guys was one of those reset to zero function, then the decoded text would no longer track the plain text. So each of them will have to be identity or flip. But because plain text and decoded text are actually the same, they're perfectly correlated, it can only be both identity or both flip. Those are the only two options. And then choosing these weights, you need to choose these weights to be able to explain the fact that this ciphertext was uniformly distributed as zero or one. That's exactly what I would get if this first function were equally likely to be identity or flip. So that's how I explain what I've observed. And now that I know that, I can immediately infer that my marginal distribution over the function f down here is just a half identity plus a half flip. And that's what I wanted to show, that I can learn more than just the do conditional. I can learn that it really is a causal connection between the plain text and the ciphertext. Maybe it's identity, maybe it's flip. I don't know if K is unobserved, which it is, but I know that they're causally connected to one another. And that, for example, if somebody came along and flipped the plain text, then the ciphertext would flip as well. That's something that's known just based on what's observed. Okay, so that's pretty much it for today. Let me stop and ask if there are any questions about that.
Can you explain again? You said that reset is not possible here. So, if, for example, if you're for F, you had like a reset to zero,
yep.
Then whatever D is, it's not possible. I don't quite understand what you.
Okay, so suppose that the ciphertext were determined by the plain text by the function reset to zero. So that would mean the ciphertext is going to take value zero regardless of whether the plain text takes value zero or one. So now up here at the decoding, this decoded variable has to be some function of the ciphertext. The only causal pathway between the plain text and the decoded text is via the ciphertext, right? So if the decoded text is going to depend on the plain text at all, it's going to be via the ciphertext. But the ciphertext has lost all information about the plain text when you reset it to zero. And so there's no choice of functional dependence of D on C that can make the effective dependence of D on T identity. This perfect correlation is telling me that the effective dependence of D on T is identity. D is tracking T perfectly. The only way to explain that is if either both of these are identity or both of these are flip. Every other choice will lead to a different effective function between T and D.
Right. But this looks very limited, though. I mean, this is like you had perfect control over the circuit, and then you said, okay, I looked at the joint distribution, and I can infer this very perfectly. But I think in the general case, doesn't it become impossible to do this?
In general, it's going to be very hard to extract something like, you know, a distribution over functions for this particular pair of variables that you're interested in. Yes. So, you know, in particular, like, as I move away from the perfect correlations here, you know, that's going to degrade my ability to make these kinds of inferences. So you're right that this is not the generic situation. All I was trying to emphasize here is that you don't always have to settle for estimating the do conditional. So, like, I made this argument that the do conditional loses a lot of information, like this randomizing channel that exists between the plain text and the ciphertext. That's what the do conditional is. It doesn't tell you whether the ciphertext is depending, you know, it's an equal mixture of identity and flip, or whether it's an equal mixture of reset to zero, reset to one. It doesn't tell you that. And in this particular example, I can resolve that ambiguity and say, oh no, it's definitely identity or flip and not the mixture of reset to one based on what I've observed.
Right, and by the way, this is all classical, correct? Because you're taking copies and you're looking at, like, for example, you're taking a copy of C and you're looking at the ciphertext, and also you're putting it into another part of the circuit. So this is all classical. How are you both seeing C and also looking at it? Because I assume that dot thing is just making a copy of whatever you have. So it's classical.
I didn't quite catch the question. So can you just repeat the question part of that?
Yes, everything is classical here because you're making copies of it.
Yes. Yes. Everything I've talked about in this lecture is the classical case. So all these variables that I've been talking about are classical variables. They just take a value in some set of possibilities. And when I want a given classical variable to influence two variables, for example, then the way I conceptualize that is that a copy is made. And one copy influences one variable and the other copy influences the other. But yeah, that's exactly what these copy operations mean. So yeah, we're later in the course, we're going to talk about the quantum generalizations of a lot of these notions. And this copy operation obviously is not going to go through for quantum systems because of the no cloning theorem. That's going to be one place where the quantum case is different. But for the beginning, I kind of need to set out the classical scheme and sort of tell you a little bit about how causal inference is done classically so that we sort of know what we're trying to generalize. And I've presented things in a kind of non-traditional manner. This is the way I've presented it today is not the way you'll see it in the causal inference textbooks, but that's partly because, you know, if you're interested in the quantum generalization, it's better to think a little bit differently. And so these passive observation schemes where I sort of learn everything there is to know about this variable C by having a copy of it and measuring it is a one particular kind of classical intervention on C. It's the one that's always studied by causal inference, but it doesn't have an analog in quantum theory. So that makes it useful to sort of study a broader set of classical possibilities. So I'm going to try to give a kind of broader view on classical causal inference, mostly because I want to sort of prepare us for the quantum case.
Okay, thank you.
So is there a rewriting theory known for this, like complete rewriting theory to reason with these diagrams?
So I have a paper with John Selby and David Schmidt. John Selby has a lot of experience with string diagrams and symmetric monoidal categories. And yeah, we tried in that paper to have a kind of formalism for doing any calculations that you would normally do diagrammatically. But the truth is we're not quite there yet. So we haven't formalized everything that you could do using these kinds of diagrams. So for us, it's mostly, I find the diagrams are just useful for sort of making certain kinds of distinctions. And I'm not gonna sort of use them to do proofs generally. But if you're interested, I can point you to the paper where, you know, we attempt to come up with a framework like this.
Okay, because you do talk about equality as a diagram, right? And at that point, like knowing the rewriting theory would be very useful. Because
yeah. Yes.
I think the problem are also something which we don't know what's happening inside of it.
Oh yeah, thank you.
The box is different from like the triangle from any input.
So I'm having trouble hearing what Katie's saying right now.
No, it was just a discussion.
Yeah, well, he was asking like, why do they have triangles there? And I was like, well, they have triangles because they're just like hidden. If it was a diagram, it would just be like an infinite variable. But
yeah, in this formalism, you're what it's supposed to do is really distinguish, for example, like one of these vertical triangles is a particular function that sets a variable to some value. That's something that happens in the real world. Whereas these blue triangles are states of knowledge. They're, you know, dependent on what you know. And so it's useful to distinguish those diagrammatically, because if I, you know, update my knowledge, then the blue triangles change, but the real world stays the same regardless of what my knowledge is. Okay, are there other questions? Okay, if not, we'll end there for today. Next time we're going to move on to talking about the connection between the causal structure and the kinds of independent intense relations that hold in the observed distribution. So, see you next Monday.